Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters. I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
Today we're welcoming Mr. David Salu to the podcast. He is a surgeon and the author of the autobiographical book, Did He Save Lives?, where he chronicles his medical career and the tragic circumstances of a death that resulted in him being convicted of manslaughter and serving 15 months in prison. He came from humble beginnings in Sierra Leone and then completed his medical education in Manchester. He spent the majority of his career working first as a senior lecturer in surgery at the University of London at Hammersmith Hospital and then as an NHS consultant colorectal surgeon in West London. His life was irrevocably changed following the death of a patient in a private hospital in Harrow, which ultimately resulted in a manslaughter conviction. After serving his time in prison, Mr. Salu was released and he was granted an appeal. His conviction was overturned and he has since been exonerated of blame and restored to the medical register. Without further ado, here is a man himself and we'll be talking on medical error and blame culture.
Hi, Mr. Salu. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, hello.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to talk about this very important subject.
Brilliant. Yeah. And you know what's interesting? I think this season particularly, we've had so many guests who have been so candid about their story. And I don't think we've really ever had that really in medicine over the past couple of years. So thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Absolutely. So I recently finished reading your book, which we'll come to talk about throughout the podcast.
Okay.
It was a fantastic read. You were so open about all of your experiences and like just the struggles of everything that had happened. And honestly, I feel like it's really an honour to meet you, like just after reading everything. And even whilst I was reading it, talking to colleagues at work, so many people had heard of your story, are so sympathetic. And I think for everyone, this is going to be like a fantastic episode.
Me and Suba like fangirling and so excited over here.
Well, it's been a big story, as I'm sure you know and you've said. It's a story that gripped medicine and has huge implications on the way we practice medicine, as we're going to talk about in this podcast.
Absolutely.
So, Mr. Salu, do you mind just recapping? Actually, let's start from the beginning, if that's okay. So you grew up in Sierra Leone?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and how you came into coming into medicine in the first place.
Well, I was born in Sierra Leone, which, as you know, is in West Africa.
Yes, yes.
As you say, humble beginnings. I went to school purely by chance because I managed to read and write even before I was able to go to school. It was that ability that got me into school. I didn't know when I was born, but when I got to school, my headmaster allocated a date of birth based purely on the ability to read. But it was a difficult struggle there, but I managed, I did well, and I went to secondary school. I got an international scholarship to come to the United Kingdom.
So okay.
That's how I ended up in the UK.
And were you in Manchester initially, or were you somewhere else?
No, I went to Manchester. I spent just a short amount of time in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you the story about when I first arrived in London.
I love this story.
I was in a British Council hostel. The British Council were very accommodating, as it were. And when I had my briefing in Freetown before I came, they said, when you get to London, just look out for our reception committees. And somebody very kindly put us in a van, took us to this hostel in Knightsbridge. on a street called Hearn's Crescent.
It's a nice place to be in a hostel, isn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes, yes. Anyway, in the morning, I woke up, wanted to brush my teeth, comb my hair, and I realised that I'd left my toothbrush, my toothpaste, and my comb back.
Also, I relate to that because that's me when I travel. As all my friends know, literally, don't have any of the essentials.
Yeah, so I got out of Hearn's Crescent and walked onto this huge road. I'd never seen anything like it before, into a shop the like of which I'd never seen before. Bright lights and lots of merchandise and so on. I walked in and I asked this man, I said, I'm from Sierra Leone. This is my first time in London. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to buy a comb, a toothbrush, and some toothpaste. He looked at me very sympathetically and he said, sir, I think a shop you want is not us. Walk out through that door, turn left, walk over Hearn's Road, and it's on your left. You can't miss it. You know, the old British way of saying Anyway, it was much later when I arrived in Manchester and during Freshers Week, when we were talking about our experiences, that I told them about my encounter, and the shop was called Harrods. So you can imagine the reception I got.
Actually comedy.
Talking about my first encounters in London. But that was an exciting time, yes.
I imagine also on the flip side, that shop assistant being like, oh, the most hilarious guy walked in today.
couldn't stop his laugh. But yeah. He was very polite. Yes.
And also, you could have just been spending so much money if you did that in Harrods.
Yes, yeah. It's not a good place to buy a car.
No.
So you bumped into the right person, I feel, on that first day. Yeah.
So you both went to Manchester, so I feel like we need to touch on that. You're both Manchester medics, aren't you?
Is that right? Okay.
Mm. Yeah, I absolutely love that city, so yeah.
Amelie always raves about Manchester.
Yes, great place. I mean, the things I liked about Manchester were really two. First, the first time I saw snow was in Manchester.
Oh.
Coming from a hot country, snow was not
of course.
Something I'd been used to. But I also liked going to Manchester United, and George Best, of course.
I knew there was going to be a football story.
There was a football story. And the first time I watched him play football, that was magical.
Oh, that's amazing. That was,
two very wholesome experiences.
Yes, remembering I came to medical school and I'm talking here about football. Anyway, it was a nice place, great place. Yeah, I have very fond memories of Manchester.
So from there, you obviously went on to become a colorectal surgeon. And you ended up back down in London, not at the doors of Harrods this time.
No, tried
Still
to keep
West
away
London.
From the place, yeah. Yes, I was a senior lecturer in surgery at the then Royal Postgraduate Medical School, which subsequently became subsumed into Imperial College, based at Hammersmith Hospital. And then in the year 2000, I moved on to pure NHS practice away from academia. At Ealing Hospital in West London.
Mm.
And that's where I was working in 2000 onwards. In 2010, as we'll come to the story in a minute, I was practicing in a private hospital called the Clementine Churchill Hospital in Harrow.
Mm.
And that's where the story that we're going to be talking about really all began.
And can I just ask, just generally, over that period of time, so from medical school through to the earlier stages of your training, was there ever any appreciation for the law and doctors? Or was there anything like in the news at the time that made you think, okay, this is something we need to think about and take seriously?
Well, I'd never been taught anything about the law. It was obviously something that was there and we had to obey it. I think the thing about doctors, all of us, is that we wake up in the morning, we want to do good, and we feel we always do good, and therefore we're not really in the frame of mind of breaking the law.
Yeah.
So I think the law was something that was a long way away from everything that we did. But of course, the law is embroiled in our practice in ways that we don't really appreciate, but are very intricate. Every time you put a hand on a patient, there is an implicit legal obligation between you and that patient that you're going to treat them well. And I think patients obviously expect to be treated in a legal, lawful way. And that's something that we respect. Every time you take a consent from a patient, especially now in the light of Montgomery, which I'm sure you've all heard about, the obligation that you now have to the patient is now embroiled also in law. And if you transgress in your taking a consent from a patient, you could be accused of battery, you could be accused of grievous bodily harm. When you operate on somebody in the operating theater and you put a knife on them and you hadn't taken a proper consent, you could also be doing grievous bodily harm. When you see them on the wards, when you see them in outpatient clinics and so on, there is a legal obligation between you and them. We don't recognize it, partly because I think we don't transgress often enough, or we don't see people transgress often enough to see that side of things. But it is a very important part of everyday clinical practice for everyone, junior doctors as well as seniors.
And I think it's so interesting that you're giving us this perspective, because for us, even when we started this podcast, our first case that we ever discussed was the case of Dr. Bawa Garba. And when we looked at that case, I think for us, that was quite shocking to us, because we see systemic failures happen all the time, and they don't often end in a legal conviction or legal proceedings, but we can see that how the team can impact and create that kind of scenario. So I think it's interesting what you've just said about the individual relationship between one doctor and one patient, which we just haven't really appreciated until
But also,
recently.
As you correctly say, there are systemic issues. We practice in a profession that is hugely underfunded. And the reason that we've got to be careful about the law is that when things go wrong, the law often tends to hold the doctor responsible, irrespective of the system in which they've worked. You mentioned the case of Hadiza Bawa Garba. Those who've read about Hadiza Bawa Garba will know that Hadiza was working in a very stretched environment. She was doing the job of about three or four doctors. The IT system that was supposed to be helping her had broken down. And yet, in spite of all of that, she tried her best.
Absolutely.
Despite that, when things did go wrong, the systemic factors were all shoved to one side, and she was held responsible. And I think the one thing that we're trying to get the law to recognize is that medicine is not practiced in a vacuum. It's not as if you're taking the patient away in your own front room and treating them. You're treating them in an environment where there should be adequate provisions, where there are other people also looking after the patient, other doctors, other nurses, technicians, etc. And when something does go wrong, I think it's important for the law to recognize that all of these systemic factors do come into play and not merely hold the one individual responsible for a system that's hugely underfunded.
Absolutely.
Just to say also that doctors are not trying to be above the law. We all want to operate within the law. But I think what the law has got to recognize that the system is considerably more complex than the simple system that's often portrayed in television programs.
You're touching on the fact that medical care is a collaborative system, and the law is trying to find, in a case of a failure or an error, is trying to find intent, criminal intent, or malpractice or negligence. And it's very complicated if you're looking at a system. If a system's failing, then it's not easy to target one perpetrator or a single issue, because it's so much more complex than that.
Yes, I think let's just be clear. There are doctors very occasionally who want to do harm. We know the case of Harold Shipman.
Of course, exactly.
And there have been other cases of doctors who have gone out of their way purely to cause harm. But the vast majority of doctors get up in the morning, want to do good, and have no criminal intent. And yet they can end up on the wrong side of the law.
Yeah, and that's basically what we're here to talk about today, isn't it?
Yes.
So maybe Mr. Sello, if you could sort of give us, for listeners of ours that may not be familiar with your case, if you could perhaps give them a quick overview, and then we can sort of get into the real meat of what we're here to talk about today.
Okay, it's all, as you say, chronicled in my memoir, Did He Save Lives? A Surgeon's Story. It all started in 2010 when I was doing a private clinic in the Clementine Churchill Hospital. One of my colleagues knocked on my door and said, David, I've got a patient on whom I did a total knee replacement 5 days ago. He's got abdominal pain. Would you see him? And I said, yes. Is it okay to see him after I finished my clinic? He said, yes. So I did go to see the patient. I arranged a number of investigations. I operated on him ultimately. There were delays in performing that operation for reasons that I'll explain in a moment. In any case, the patient was hugely overwhelmed by his disease. This was a natural condition that had arisen, which even in the best circumstances, in the best hospitals, carries significant mortality. He died, and I was held to blame for his death. I was investigated, firstly by the hospital, and then ultimately by the coroner, and then by the GMC, and then by the law. My trial was held at the Old Bailey. I was convicted of the patient's manslaughter, and I was sent to prison. I came out, and as you've said in the introduction, we mounted an appeal. That appeal was successful, and it was overturned. I'd also been in front of the GMC on a number of occasions on the same charges. I was completely cleared of the charges, and here I am. So that's the story in a nutshell.
In a very literal
nutshell.
Yeah, very literally in a nutshell.
Nutshell, yeah.
Yeah. So perhaps I think maybe a good place for us to start would be when there is a significant event in a hospital or a serious incident, SIs as we know them. The process is generally that there'll be an internal investigation initially. And in your case, I understand that there was a report that was written and that was an external body that gave that report. Is that correct?
Yes, I think only to first of all emphasise that we are probably the only profession that is so extensively investigated following an incident. In other professions, the process is much shorter, much smoother perhaps, and the consequence is not as grave. In medicine, there is a whole range of investigations that happen when there's an untoward incident. Yes, it first kicked off by the hospital wanting to deflect blame for a number of systemic issues that I'll talk about later on in the podcast. But they wanted to hold somebody responsible for the patient's death other than themselves. So what they did was they hired an external company, not quite sure how independent that external company was, because as I'll mention in a moment, the director of that company actually ultimately took a senior job in the hospital establishment. So whether he was entirely partial is something that I often talk about. He, that director of that inquiry company, also got a colorectal surgeon from a hospital in Burton-on-Trent. And again, one of the things that that surgeon did not declare is that he worked in a hospital where the mortality rate for elective colorectal surgery had been the highest in the country. One out of every six of their patients who they'd operated on electively had died following their operations. So here was somebody coming to investigate an incident who himself had not been working in an entirely blame-free environment. And between the two of them, they produced a report that was very critical of me. Now, one of the things that we're going to be talking about later on is the whole issue of what you call expert witnesses, the people who are asked to adjudicate when things go wrong. But they issued a very damning report, and that report was the first in a whole series of reports that was very critical of the way that I'd managed the patient, and that escalated that case to a coroner's inquest, ultimately to the GMC, and finally to the law. The law requires that when there is a serious incident, there should be two investigations. If there is somebody being held responsible or under suspicion for that death, they should be investigated quite clearly. We accept that. But the hospital were also under obligation to investigate their own processes. Mm-hmm. And they did. This is what is known as the root cause analysis.
Yes, yes.
And the idea behind the root cause analysis is for the hospital to also look at its own processes. Mm-hmm. Because as we say, medicine is a complex field. And when something goes wrong, we've got to look at the whole thing in totality. The hospital's root cause analysis was actually carried out by one of their own quality managers. That quality manager produced an RCA, as I've gone to call it, because it's a little bit shorter than calling it a root cause analysis, produced an RCA, which was very critical of the hospital's provisions. For example, there was no emergency theater, there was no emergency anesthetic rota, etc. The intensive care unit was supposed to provide outreach care to people on the wards, and it didn't do all of that. And the RCA highlighted a large number of failings of the hospital. Unfortunately, that root cause analysis was hidden from us during my investigations.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't know of the existence of that document until much, much later, when it was really too late. We found out about this document following a subject access analysis request when I was doing my appeal. It was only then that the document surfaced. So had that document, as it should have been, been present at the time that these inquiries were taking place, I think there would have been a fairer, more balanced assessment of exactly what happened. But the coroner saw the report that was critical of me, but not the root cause analysis. The GMC never saw the RCA. The criminal, the Crown Court, never saw the RCA. So the judgment was all against me rather than the establishment itself.
And what surprises me about that story as well is that it seems like all these different bodies didn't appreciate that there would be a hospital or systems-wide failing that's probably occurred alongside that. How comes that wasn't ever... do you know why that they never went down that route?
Well, it's quite possible in law for one person to be held responsible for a crime, even though there were others involved. But I think that medicine is much more complex than that.
And I would also expect the GMC to be aware of those things. That's why I was asking.
Yes. Ultimately, they did take that into consideration. But during my trial, whenever there was any mention of any systems or any body, the judge would say, oh, no, it's David Selu that's on trial, not the hospital, etc., which is clearly wrong. That's now being fixed. And one of the recommendations that's being made to the law is that medicine is too complex, and therefore when these problems do occur, that systems should be adequately taken into consideration. And in fact, the there was Lord Mackay was a lord, he was in the House of Lords, was one of the people who actually initiated this law of gross negligence manslaughter. And he was very insistent that if a doctor is being held responsible for an incident, he or she should be judged in the circumstances in which they found themselves, rather than in isolation of those circumstances. But for reasons unclear, this has never been the case. So, you know, we're where we are, but hopefully things will change.
So when we're talking about expert witnesses being called to a case to provide what you assume is an impartial perspective on what would be expected of a doctor in a certain circumstance, of course, we were saying that in your case, that that wasn't the case. The expert witness wasn't necessarily completely impartial and giving a fair judgment, free from judgment. So are there any ways that in your experience that the law is expected to protect medical professionals?
Like, how do you hold the expert witness to account now?
Yeah, basically.
Well, first of all, the word the expression expert witness is a bit of a misnomer.
It almost sounds Hollywood.
The word expert is wrong because these people were never trained. The most of the people who gave evidence in my case had never given evidence in a civil or criminal court.
Mm.
So you can't really call yourself an expert not ever having done the job.
Yeah.
They'd not been trained to provide expert witnesses. These are people that are just snatched at random or who hold themselves to be experts.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
The other word that's a misnomer is witness. They are the people who were never there when the events happened, and therefore the word witness is a bit of a misguided word.
Mm.
Yeah, so they're not expert witnesses.
I just all, love how all they're doing
is my mind just got shattered.
They're giving opinions, and we can all give opinions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unfortunately, these people have a bit of an inflated view of themselves, and all they're really trying to do is to hold themselves up as being people who are in authority.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, in my case, for example, one of the so-called expert witnesses had actually retired from surgical practice for some time. So, you know, this was a person who probably had been in surgery, but now retired, wasn't really seeing the day-to-day problems.
Yes, because the day-to-day problems have completely changed.
Yeah. Mm.
And what I think is also interesting is it seems like the other expert witness held you to a different standard that he has held himself or the hospital in which he worked in.
And particularly when I think, when you're talking about a case like this, like what the impression is, what would a reasonable doctor or reasonable surgeon do under the circumstances? Not what you would do, not what you would like to do.
Not what the textbooks say, because one of the problems with medical practice is that it's often very easy to open a textbook and say, oh, on page 256, it says you've got to do this and that and so on, but takes absolutely no account of the circumstances in which you find themselves. I mean, I always give the example of, for example, the vaginal mesh.
Mm.
It's a little digression, but it's an interesting story. When it first came out many, many years ago, it was probably one of the best devices that there was for the treatment of female urinary incontinence.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, a lot of women were benefited by the vaginal mesh.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many, many years down the line, we now know that it caused a significant number of women considerable harm.
Mm.
Now, if you judge the surgeons who did that operation 20 years ago based on the information that was available to them, you can't really criticize them because they did the best that there was at the time using the knowledge that they knew at the time.
Mm. Absolutely.
Unfortunately, one of the things that expert witnesses do tend to forget is that medicine does change over time, and therefore, if, as in the case, in my case, my trial was in 2013, the incident happened in 2010, and a lot had changed in surgery between that time and 2013. And yet I was being held to the standards of 2013 based on things that had happened in 2010.
Absolutely.
So when you are judging somebody, you've got to judge them in their environment in which they found themselves.
At the time.
Take account of all the strictures that they were subjected to at the time and based on the knowledge that was available at the time. As you correctly say, how you judge another surgeon is not what you would do or it's not what the textbooks say is ideal.
Mm.
It's what a reasonable body of surgeons would do given the facilities that they had at their disposal. So it's an interesting concept. It's an important concept in law. But this is one that expert so-called witnesses do tend to forget sometimes.
Mm. And this must have been an incredible, like, traumatic experience for yourself and your family at the time. Can I ask, how did you initially process what was going on for you, just on a personal level?
But just to say, first of all, that there was a victim in all of this, and that was a patient.
Mm.
And we must not forget that we are not the only people that suffer when things like this happened.
Mm.
There was a patient who died. There was a family at the end who wanted answers.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, as happened in my case, because the finger was pointed at the wrong person, the family never really got the answers that they wanted. So let's not forget that the most important victim in all of this is the patient and the family. Mm. But coming back to the issue of myself, of course, you know, I'd had what I believed was an unblemished career for over 40 years. I'd, in my view, saved numerous lives, which is why the title of my book, because when I was judged and convicted and so on, the fact that I'd saved countless number of lives was never taken into consideration when the judgment was passed on me. But it was a very traumatic event, not just for me, but also for my family. And I think they too are the people that are often forgotten in all of this. Because the events that took place were purely things that happened that they were due to, or judged to be either my actions or inactions, and nothing to do with my family. And yet, at the end of it, I lost my career, I lost my salary, my children were in university, they were trying to forge a career, we had a mortgage, we had commitments that we had to commit to, etc. And yet, suddenly, one day, my salary was stopped. So you can imagine the impact of that, quite apart, of course, from the fact that, you know, I'd lost a patient. And that loss was entirely not my fault, as circumstances were to show.
Yeah. It's just an unbelievable thing. Like, it just blows my mind. But I found even more shocking was just the absolute lack of support that you talk about in the book from places where you would expect that you would be able to get support for someone going through this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I know you do talk about your colleagues being like personally very supportive, but from organisations such as the BMA or the Royal Colleges, I know in your book you talk about not getting much support at all. And is that something that's changed since? Have you had conversations with those organisations since?
Yes, things are changing. First of all, when something like this happens, I think you'd expect a lot of support from your base organisation. Unfortunately, the base organisation that I was working at was really more of a business than a medical establishment. I think they're there mainly to make money rather than unfairly, perhaps, for me to say so, but I think making money was more their primary aim rather than looking after patients. What they want to do is not to bring that business model into any disrepute. But equally, when these things happen, there are lots of consequences, psychological, logistic, financial, and so on. And you're looking at other bodies that can help. First of all, the psychological consequences are enormous.
Yeah.
We know that one doctor kills themselves every 3 weeks on average in the United Kingdom while they are under investigation by the GMC. And these are often people who are young, who've got families, who've got children attending schools, etc. And the psychological consequences are huge. One of the things that I think every doctor ought to do is to seek psychological help at the very first opportunity. But I think on a practical level, what you want to do is to get away from your own hospital and go to somewhere where you can get that help anonymously, perhaps. Maybe not anonymously, but where you can get it confidentially.
Free of judgment.
Without having the rest of your colleagues know about it.
And
one of the organisations that we were looking at, that I was looking at, was, for example, the BMA that I'd been a staunch supporter of since I was a medical student. And also, I was also fellow of two Royal Colleges, the College of Surgeons of England and the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. I sought help from all of these bodies, and unfortunately, I got no help. I was in a meeting with the presidents of the Colleges of Surgeons of England and of Glasgow, and this issue came up. They were very apologetic. It's it's an issue that they're now very seriously considering taking on board and changing. But, you know, these are bodies, I mean, we are trained, as you know, to be non-judgmental. We, as surgeons, for example, will treat people with vascular disease who've been smokers. We treat people whose lifestyles lead directly to their diseases without any judgment. And yet, unfortunately, when one of their own colleagues gets into trouble, they're often very judgmental. Ah, it was his fault. He should have done A, B, C, and so on and so forth, didn't follow the rules, etc., without even knowing the details of exactly what happened. So it's that judgmental attitude that I think we really need to get away from. But yes, these establishments are now coming on board in that regard.
And I think we're so fortunate to be at the point in our careers where we've come through after these cases have unfortunately happened to people like you. And now maybe there is a bit more scrutiny in terms of before things even get to trial. What I'm struggling to understand is why these institutions weren't there to support you, why they weren't there to like hear what you were saying and not judge you just because the media has judged you.
Well, first of all, as I say, the institution where this happened was a private hospital.
Yeah.
And understandably, perhaps, from their point of view, they wanted the deflection to be away from them and the gun to be pointed at somebody else. But I think equally, the NHS hospitals that have no financial interest in that way should also be more supportive.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the recommendations that's being made, that been made following the recent inquiries into all of these incidents, is that more support should be provided for doctors who, and it's not just doctors, of course, we've got to be aware that there are other
healthcare colleagues
who come under the same sort of scrutiny that one of the people who was convicted of manslaughter, for example, was a nurse in Leicester at the same time as Hadiza Bahagaba. And they too have their own regulatory bodies that equally hold them to account when these things go wrong. But I think that the establishment must really begin to take account of the fact that there are systemic issues that must be corrected, first of all, and should also be taken into account.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And these incidents occur.
I think what Amelie was trying to get at was actually, so of course with hospitals and private institutions, we understand they may have other reasons for wanting to try and point the finger. But when we're talking about organisations such as the BMA or
the Royal Colleges,
of course they're there to support their doctors. So where was the gap in terms of them not wanting to be supportive for yourself when you'd been a member with them for so long?
And just to follow on from that question, when I think about like the GMC from I say, well, it's still very much relevant in their practices now. Sorry, what I'm thinking, let me say my words, is with the GMC investigations, we all know that they have been biased. It's a historically racist institution.
Absolutely.
And that's actually a lot of the institutions in the UK, including the police. We can look at the Stephen Lawrence cases and understand, okay, the numbers of people that were even reporting to the GMC is just disproportionate when you're thinking about people who are black or from another minority ethnic group.
Yeah, I think just to take you on that point, the GMC deny that there is any racism in the way that they investigate their cases.
Oh, I thought now, was there not a report?
No, this is recent.
Let's just be very careful about that report. What that report was put up to do was to look at why there is a disproportionate number of black and ethnic minority practitioners referred to the GMC. What that committee was not allowed to do was to look at whether, when those cases got to the GMC, there was any racial bias in the way that the decisions were made from that point on.
Okay. I see.
So there is no doubt about the fact that the majority doctors who get referred to the GMC are from black and ethnic minority, far disproportionate.
Okay.
The number of doctors, for example, in ethnic doctors in healthcare is between 20-30%.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the number of people who get referred to the GMC is about, the proportion is more than 90%. That there's no question about.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, what that committee was not allowed to do was to then determine whether from that point at which they got to the GMC, there was any racial bias in the way that the GMC made its decisions. Now, the GMC argues that when doctors get to that point, there is no disproportionality. There are people who, of course, argue that there is disproportionality.
Mm.
That, for example, if you have an ethnic minority person commit a certain misdemeanor as compared to a white person, that the sanctions that are imposed are different. They're stiffer and so on ethnic minority person. But the GMC denies that. And unfortunately, that committee didn't go that far down the line to really look at that, whether there was disproportionality there. What is not in doubt is that the number of ethnic minority people referred to the GMC is way, way disproportionate. No question about that. And as you say, also the same in the law. And it's the same also for other regulators.
Of course.
Regulate medicine and nursing, etc.
Actually, it's quite a crucial question. So it's a shame they didn't pursue that further to find out if there is bias within the GMC. But anyways, that's a question for another day, I think.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other episode.
That is a whole other question. So, Mr. Selu, obviously for our listeners, we've got a predominantly like junior doctor listening group.
Yes.
So we're kind of often maybe slightly protected in the sense that when we're practicing, there's always a responsible clinician who is obviously always the consultant.
Yeah.
So you're working under the consultant's instructions. So in the case of SIs or errors, it often filters back up to the consultant. What's your impression on how the criminalisation of medical error, like how will that filter down to junior doctors? Should we be scared? Should we be taking things into consideration, or is it something that's kind of still from a slightly higher up level, more affecting the consultant group?
Well, I don't want people to be scared of practicing medicine. I think scare is perhaps not really the right word.
No.
We all go out, we want to do good.
Yeah.
Let's continue to do good. What we've got to be aware of, however, is that we are going to be held for our own actions. There is a misconception, perhaps, that if you're a junior doctor and you make a mistake, your consultant is going to be held responsible for that. No. Depending on how your consultant or your registrar supervised you, if you're an FY1 or an FY2, they too would carry responsibility, but you are going to be held responsible for your own actions based on your level of knowledge. Obviously, the law or the regulator is not going to judge you as against the competence of a registrar. If you're an FY1, for example, you're not expected to be acting like a registrar, but you should be responsible to act like a competent FY1. If you transgress against those sorts of rules, yes, you will be held responsible. So let's not have the misconception that somehow if something goes wrong, your registrar or your consultant is the one that's going to be held responsible. Yes, they can be held responsible if they haven't supervised you adequately. So, you know, if I give you a scalpel and I say to you, not having done an appendicectomy before, go and take out that appendix and you go and do it badly, then, of course, I would have failed in my responsibility to you. But equally, you will be held responsible for your own actions as judged against what you should reasonably know as an FY1 or FY2 or whatever your level of training. So you do have responsibility for your own actions.
I think something else that we should definitely touch on is defensive practice.
Yes.
With the increasing number of convictions or charges being brought against doctors, and I would say in perhaps in recent days, have you noticed in your own practice that people are changing in the way that they're practicing medicine? And how does that negatively impact patients?
Well, let's just be clear, first of all, about what we mean by
defensive practice.
Defensive practice is the practice that we do in order primarily to protect ourselves and to cover our own backs. Let me give you an example. If you're a GP sitting in a surgery and a child comes along who's got a bit of a cough, slight temperature, you say to yourself, well, I think it's a viral infection. I should really reassure the parents to go away, give the child some paracetamol and plenty of water, etc. In somebody who's practicing defensively, what they would do would be to prescribe antibiotics to that child, because they know that in the majority it's going to be a viral infection, but occasionally it may turn out to be a bacterial infection that should have been treated with antibiotics. Now, what we're doing there is giving perhaps 20 children antibiotics when perhaps only one should have been given antibiotics, so we don't miss that one patient who may turn out to have a bacterial infection. Now, what that does is we know what happens when we inappropriately prescribe antibiotics. Another example is...
And even on from that, of course, we can talk about antibiotic resistance, but also and that's what I wanted to pick you up on. I'm happy he picked you up on the statement defensive practice.
Yeah.
The defensive practice only tends to really be a symptom of someone trying to cover their own back. So now if we actually go back to what clinical medicine is meant to do and how we're meant to like reassure our patients and educate them.
Yeah.
Educate them, particularly these a parent, because I work in pediatrics mainly. So with parents, so many of them will be anxious. They're so scared that their child has tonsillitis or is bacterial. But actually, you as a doctor, with your own clinical information, you can now empower them and educate them. So I think you tend to lose all of those like psychosocial important things as well when your focus now becomes, okay, I must cover my own back.
What you've got to bear in mind, though, is talking from the point of view of the clinician is...
Yeah.
Occasionally, one of those cases will turn out to be a tonsillitis that you'd reassured and sent home.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of case that's going to be in the press.
Yes.
This child was seen by X number of doctors. They failed to diagnose tonsillitis. They reassured the mother that the child had a viral infection and therefore said, go away and everything is going to be fine. This is what doctors are fearing. I mean, another example...
But then I suppose the addendum to that as well is maybe because we also are aware of cases similar to yours, is that we will now be aware that we need to safety net them or to provide like certain information. If so-and-so happens, this is what you need to do.
Well, think of there was that case of the an optometrist called Honey Rose.
What a name! Sounds like a TV character.
She was an Indian. She was an Indian optometrist practicing in a high street chemist. When a child came in and had an eye examination, and she missed papilledema in that child. And sometime much later, that child died from a brain tumour. And when people looked back, they found that the child actually had papilledema, which should have been picked up on that original optometry test. Now, what do you say to parents like that? That optometrist, incidentally, was convicted of the manslaughter of that child, but that conviction was ultimately overturned, I think, quite sensibly. But I think it's that kind of scenario that doctors are worried about. That, yes, you can reassure the mother. I tell them, if this happens and that happens, come back. But I think when all of this happens, that sort of information gets forgotten in the whole process. So I think that doctors are very aware of this. I mean, the other example I was going to give of defensive practice was, if you have 1,000 patients with headaches, probably on average one of them will have a brain tumor. Now, the others will not have a brain tumor, maybe because they've not been drinking enough, or maybe they've been drinking too much, or they've got migraine, or they've got some functional headache, or whatever. And what a defensive practitioner will do is to send every single one of those 1,000 people to have CT scans of their brains, so as not to miss that one patient who might have a brain tumor. Now, what does that do? All of those people who are having brain scans are now going to be very anxious because the doctor thinks I may have something wrong in my brain. And look at the anxiety that's going to be generated in the time that they're going to be going through that process. And of course, one of the other things that will happen is that brain scan may pick up something totally benign that would never have come to light in the lifetime of that patient. And there'll now be more investigations carried out for that lesion. Creating more anxiety, with blocking brain scans for other people who really richly deserve that investigation, and so on. So defensive practice is bad medicine for patients.
I think it's so clear that you talk about like learning that we can do from all these kind of events. What sort of things have you shared with people in terms of how do we now like move towards like a duty of candor rather than like a blame culture?
Well, I think the duty of candor is really primary in medicine. Our patients expect it. One of the things that we should talk about is what patients and parents expect when they come to medicine. I think patients deserve to be treated correctly, with the right sort of knowledge, etc., and they obviously deserve to be treated with considerable respect. This is what we all here for. When things go wrong, patients want primarily three things out of four. The first is for us to put up our hands and say, sorry, we got it wrong as practitioners. And to mean that, not merely to say it, because that's what's expected of us. The second thing that patients and parents want us to do is to give them an adequate explanation as to why whatever went wrong, went wrong. Because they deserve that. If they're going to put any sort of closure to, for example, somebody who's died, I think they want to understand exactly what it was that happened to their loved one. The third thing that patients want is to be reassured that if we've made a mistake, that we are going to learn from that mistake, so that it doesn't happen to other patients in the future. Now, we often have this misconception that what people want is compensation. Yes, of course people deserve compensation if they should be compensated. I mean, if you've got a taxi driver who is paralyzed following a spinal operation that's gone wrong and they now can't do their job, they've got bills to pay, etc., I think they deserve to be compensated. But primarily, what patients want are those three things. It's when we don't offer those three things that people feel that the only way they're going to get redress is to seek compensation. But that is really the last thing that's often on patients' minds when these things happen. So in terms of the duty of candor.
And I think just to add on from what you're saying, it's important for us to be aware that we can just, even if we don't have the answers there and then, it's important for us to show that we're trying to get those answers,
and just
to keep them very involved in the conversation, because you can be doing certain actions, but unfortunately, if what you've said to them hasn't been okay, that's what we're working on at the moment.
It can be confrontational.
Absolutely.
The problem with the duty of candor from the point of view of doctors is this, that doctors are worried that if you put up your hands now and you say, oh, yes, I did that, I take responsibility for that, and there is then subsequently a case, either civil or criminal, what you've said today is going to be held against you in a court of law.
Okay. Absolutely.
And this clearly happened in my case.
Yeah.
I was very candid in all the interviews that I gave, and every single thing that I said was written down, and it was looked at in very minute detail during my the criminal investigation. He said this, he said this, I should have done this, and didn't do that, and so on. And I think this is obviously bad for learning, because what it does do is it discourages doctors and practitioners from being candid from the word go, because they know or they suspect that if they are candid, any words of candor that they express now are going to come to haunt them, because those words are going to be forensically examined in a court of law and held against them. That's obviously bad for candor.
Yeah, and that's a crucial issue when duty of candor is such a core tenet of medicine and of building a doctor-patient relationship. Like, your patient trusts that you are truthful and that you are reliable and that you are honest.
And that's the only way we're going to learn in future, because if we either to ourselves or to our colleagues say, look, I did that wrong, that's what I should have done. In future, this is the way we should be doing it.
Yeah.
Then it means that we're learning from our mistakes.
And we're progressing, and medicine is progressing.
What we're not doing is, by not having that duty of that candor, we are deluding ourselves that we're doing the right things for our patients, and we are avoiding that learning opportunity that really comes out of candor, which is obviously very bad for medicine.
So given that the nature of the law kind of in some way erodes sort of core tenets for us, such as duty of candor, do you think that doctors should then be judged in the eyes of the law in the way that the law judges most professions or most members of the population?
Well, first of all, just to say that we're all citizens, and we don't want to be held above the law.
No.
But what we do want the law to recognize is that the environment in which we practice is a very difficult one, that medicine is not the kind of discipline that is perceived, that the perception of medicine as a kind of a magical discipline should be dispelled. Unfortunately, in my case, there was the perception given to the jury that had he done this, had he given antibiotics at this moment in time, that patient would have been up and walking out of the hospital at such and such a time. Of course, we know that antibiotics don't work in that sort of way.
I mean, they're amazing, but it's no magic wand.
They're not they're not magical, and they can cause harm too, quite apart from the good that they do. But I think in terms of the perception that medicine is a kind of a magical field, that perception should really be taken away from the profession. It's a fallible profession, and things can go wrong, and things will go wrong. What they do in other professions, and we often use aviation as perhaps one of the models.
This is all
now,
we talk about.
Obviously, flying people from A to B is not the same as treating them in a hospital when they come in ill. And I think we've got to be careful not to equate equation
and to simplify
medicine.
It.
Nevertheless, there are things that they've done in aviation which are commendable. What they do is to encourage people to hold up their hands when things have gone wrong and say, look, I should have done X, Y, Z, but this is what I did. Let's make it clear to other people in my circumstance that this is potentially something that can go wrong, so that we can all learn from it.
Yeah.
Or if something's gone wrong and we didn't mean to do wrong, hold up our hands and say, this is what we did wrong, so that everybody can learn from it. This is how aviation has managed to make flying one of the safest forms of transportation.
Absolutely.
And I think that's such a testament to your story as well, because actually what may have been easier for you to do is to have held some of the truths back or put someone, like shove someone else under the bus. And I think it's almost, when I think of your story, I always think, oh, what could you have done? What could have been changed? But actually it sounds like it was unavoidable what you could have done to respond to this case.
Well, let's just be clear. First of all, I went to prison based on what I was alleged to have done wrong.
Yes. Mm. And that's what I'm saying.
In a criminal court. Mm. Now, the GMC and the Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service, which is a civil court, but in my view, the people who were there were more enlightened.
Yeah.
What they did do was to look at this case in its totality.
Yes.
Look at all the system provisions or lacks of provisions of systemic facilities.
Mm.
And they put all that into the mix. And they looked at this case absolutely forensically and cleared me of every single
absolutely.
Of those allegations that had been that I'd been found to be guilty of in a criminal court. So I think the message is that when things go wrong, people should be judged in the environment in which they found themselves.
Absolutely. Rather than, but what I'm saying, even listening to our listeners are primarily doctors.
Mm.
And I think it's an encouraging note. And that's what I'm trying to say is it's encouraging to know that you can have integrity.
Mm.
And even if things do fall away and things don't seem like they're going right, the fact that you were so honest and had the candor throughout the whole journey, even though it was long and it was difficult, that's what exonerated you in the end.
That candor certainly helped, because that's that's what I did express during my entire journey. But the MPTS, the Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service, where I appeared, ultimately judged this very fairly, and they found me completely blameless in all of this, in the whole process.
And if you don't mind me asking, do you mind just telling us a little bit about your son who also trained in medicine?
Yes, James was 24 years of age at the time.
Mm.
He also was a Manchester graduate, and he'd done an intercalated master's degree in medical research in Manchester and then finished his MB, CHB, all of which he passed.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time that he was doing his exam, he was coming to the Old Bailey to my trial, then going back to Manchester, reading for his finals, and ultimately he passed. And he came up, applied for his FY1, and he was given jobs in North Manchester General Hospital.
Mm.
But before he took the job, he came home one day and he said to me and my wife, "Mom, Dad, I don't want to continue in medicine at all anymore."
Mm.
So we said to him, "James, you've spent a quarter of your life as a 24-year-old reading to do medicine, and you've got very good degrees." He got his MRes with commendation. You've spent a quarter of your entire life, or you've spent your entire adult life training to be a doctor. You've got something like an £80,000 student loan on your head.
You don't have to remind us.
And you want to give all this up. Why? He said, "First of all, I'd been through the same racism that you've been through, and I can now see the harmful effects of racism in medicine. But more than that, on a personal level, when we were growing up, when it was our nativity plays, when it was our sports days, when it was our parents' teachers' evenings, you, Dad, were never there because you were busy providing care to your NHS patients. You were either stuck in theatre or you were in your hospital providing exemplary care to your patients. And yet, on account of a single incident in a 40-year career in which you'd saved countless lives, something goes wrong. And it wasn't even your fault. I think even he had picked on the fact that the trial that I'd undergone had been completely unfair. Even on just on account of that one incident, which wasn't your fault, this is the humiliation that you suffer. Mm. If that is what medicine is all about, I give up.
Yeah.
And James never went back into medicine. Mm. Now, James would have probably made a very good doctor because he was a very bright chap. He was very committed to medicine.
Mm.
And the sad news about that is that this is the kind of message that we're passing on, A, to those youngsters who want to go into medicine.
Mm.
And unfortunately, even those young practitioners in medicine are getting this wrong message from us that medicine is somehow a very toxic profession to be in.
Mm.
And even older practitioners who are coming to retirement are now retiring earlier.
Mm.
Of course, there are lots of other reasons why people are retiring early, to do with pensions so on. But I think throw into that the toxicity that we've created in medicine, I think the first thing they want to say is, I want out.
Absolutely.
And there are lots of people dropping out of medicine at various levels because of these wrong messages that we're passing on to them, which is very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that, as we know, there is a manpower crisis in medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the message that we're sending out to all of those people is really very wrong.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, it's been a 40-year career span for you. You've done so much for patients, even when you're also juggling being a father as well.
During my trial, there was this exchange, which is where the title of my book comes from, Did He Save Lives? There was an exchange between my defense barrister and one of the anesthetists that I'd worked with for nearly 20 years.
Mm.
And my defense barrister wanted to find out from this doctor, who knew me very well, just what my practice had been like. And the exchange went something like this. What sort of a doctor is David Sellew? And she then would say, oh, he was a very good doctor. If anything ever happened in our intensive care unit, he was the one that everybody would go to and ask for help, etc. Did he save lives? And the answer was an emphatic yes.
Yeah.
Mm.
I thought that was a very good title to put on my book. And that's the reason. Now, when I was sentenced to prison, I just wanted at that point to remind the people who were judging me that I had saved countless lives, and yet in spite of one incident which I didn't consider to be my fault, I was being sent to prison. That was very unfair.
Mr. Sellew, so would you be able to read for us a small excerpt from your book, Did He Save Lives, that you've spoken about?
Suba called me, and I was like, are you sure you want him to read that? And then she was like, honestly, this hurt my heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was heartbroken the whole time, but this in particular, I think, really struck a chord with me. And also the story you shared about how you got the title of your book as well, because, you know, that's the intentionality with medicine is so important. It's what drives us, right? Like you said, it's a difficult career. Mm. You make a lot of sacrifices, but what drives you is what you're trying to achieve.
Mm.
So this excerpt really struck a chord with me.
All right, the context of this excerpt is something like this. When I was finally declared guilty of manslaughter, the judge read his sentencing remarks, and the last words were, David Sellew, I sentence you to 2.5 years in prison for killing Mr. A. Now, if you read the whole narrative and if you know the outcome, of course, I didn't kill Mr. A. But that's what I was judged and convicted to have done.
Mm.
I wanted to remind the judge, or rather what the judge didn't do, was to remind the jury and all the listeners that this patient, Mr. A, had a disease which kills a significant number of people who have it, that Mr. A had other comorbidities, such as cirrhosis of his liver, which negatively impact on survival from major surgery,
mm-hmm.
that Mr. A had his operation 5 days after he'd had a previous operation. It's mm-hmm. a bit like running two marathons back to back without having time to recover from one.
Yeah.
That there were systemic failings. And when I wanted to get him into theater, there was no available theater that was staffed. When I wanted to operate on him, there was no anesthetist
mm.
to help me to operate on him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in spite of all of these, the judge said, I'm sentencing you to 2.5 years in prison for killing Mr. A.
Mm.
And that's where the excerpt comes from. I could not get the word killing out of my mind. Killing conjured up visions of me administering a lethal cocktail of drugs or using a scalpel to decapitate my patient. It filled me with confusion. I had entered medicine, the profession, to save lives. And like every practitioner, I had not always succeeded in doing so. Some deaths cannot be prevented.
Thanks so much for sharing so much with us today, Mr. Selu.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what's so funny when I think about all of this? We've always had a list of dream guests, Mr. Selu, and you're on that list of dream guests. And I'm telling you, that's only really five people. So thank you so much for coming today. Mm. It was an amazing story to hear. Amazing because you kept your integrity throughout and you have so much reflection and positive reflection coming out of the other end. And that doesn't discount all the trauma and difficulties that you and your family and also the patient and their family went through. But it's just great to hear positive voices from our seniors.
Just to say finally that I'm back practicing medicine in spite of or surgery, in spite of everything that's happened, for two reasons. Primarily, it's a profession that I enjoy doing and I'm still very proud to be helping people. Now, some people say, you're absolutely mad. And I agree with them for everything that I've been through.
Yeah,
and at my stage, I think I should have given up. But I'm doing it because it's a profession I enjoy. But also, I'm doing voluntary work in Sierra Leone.
Mm.
And the only way I'll be allowed to do voluntary work in Sierra Leone is to stay on the medical register in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And to maintain my place on the medical register, I've got to be in practice. Now, I'm not really doing a lot of work, but I am doing some work to keep my name on the medical register so that I can do voluntary work back in Sierra Leone. But also, there's obviously a lot that we've not covered in this podcast that I've chronicled very in great detail in my book, Did He Save Lives? A Surgeon's Story.
Uh-huh.
It's only £10. It's available on Amazon. So do go
and Kindle as Sibo's reading.
It really is important. And leave your reviews on Amazon.
We will,
absolutely.
It's an excellent read. I recommend.
There are lots and lots of messages in there, and
particularly
for junior doctors. What I don't want to do is to scare you from medicine. My own son decided not to carry on in medicine, but it's a wonderful profession, and it's one that I would encourage people to go into. And those who are there, do carry on. It's a noble profession. In spite of all the people out there who are judging you, do your best and give it your very best. You are helping mankind.
Yes.
It's a great profession.
And that was
And thank you for having me on this podcast.
No, you're very welcome.
So excited.
Very
thanks
privileged
for joining us.
To have been given the opportunity to talk to you.
No,
you.
Absolutely. And we've had so many great takeaways, both on personal and professional levels.
Absolutely. So don't forget to buy Did He Save Lives? By Mr. David Selu. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right,
bye.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Catch us over on www.afterTheLetters.com or /AfterTheLetters on every social media network.
Hi. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.